Well, thanks, Don. And to get started off here, I know most people do their thank yous at the end of the slide set, but I want to go ahead and thank my co-author, Taylor Grusing. She was my first graduate student and did a lot of the legwork for the data you're going to see here today. And luckily, she's a really good writer, so that means her thesis we could roll basically right into a set of proceedings, which made my life a whole lot easier as I prepared for the rest of this conference. But what I'm going to focus on here today, and amazingly, we've managed to stay on time for the most part, so I built a little smaller slide set thinking we'd be behind the eight ball in terms of time, so you guys might get a little bit of an extended break here, but the crux of what I wanted to get at today was really revolves around a question I know is going to come up repeatedly here as we start the pregnancy checking season. That is, well, do we have a problem with excess protein? Is that affecting my pregnancy rates negatively? Particularly when we get producers, they don't change their synchronization protocol. They say that pastures were good. They can't think of anything that's different this year from last year, other than maybe pastures were too good. I get that question a lot. Was pasture too good this year? Was that a problem? And so kind of trying to isolate, you know, is excess dietary protein, is it a problem in the beef herd? Being the last set of slides here in the nutrition section, a lot of this has been covered already, but I think it's safe to say we all know that undernutrition is obviously going to be a problem, right? Particularly when we look at the mature cow herd and we think about body condition score at the time of calving and how it affects reproductive function, we know that postpartum interval is extended when we have those thinner cows. So we have our cows, their body condition score 3 and 4. The classical data would suggest that it's really hard for those cows to maintain an annual calving interval 365 days. Likewise, when we look at body condition score at calving and how it relates to reproductive efficiency or fertility, that following 120 days, again, those thin cows tend to have lower pregnancy rates. Nothing real earth-shattering in that regard. You know, George just covered this slide, and so I'll breeze through this pretty quickly, but we think about nutrient partitioning. You know, we got to meet a lot of goals for this cow from a metabolic perspective so that she can actually maximize her reproductive efficiency within the herd. So George did a great job covering this, so I'll skip over it. But we often get caught up with what's the problem with undernutrition. Is there a problem with overnutrition? Is that a problem? We're not going to focus on energy today, but it's safe to say, you know, we get cows that are extremely fleshy. That has its own host of problems around the time of calving. We can run into some dystocia issues. There's been a lot of data out there that would suggest when we get cows that are too fleshy, it can compromise oocyte quality, embryonic mortality. So, yes, over-condition can be a problem. But what about protein specifically? Is too much protein a problem? And, I know this is a reproductive conference, but I think as we talk about protein, we need to spend just a couple minutes going through the digestive cycle of protein. And so when we talk about protein, we've got, and particularly for clear up until this year anyway, we've really worked on a crude protein system. So amount of total protein that goes into that cow. And that really breaks down into two fractions. We've got our rumen degradable fraction, and our rumen undegradable fraction. And depending on the feed stuff, our rumen integratable fraction may be as little as 15% on some really high quality standing pasture. It might be as low as 20, or might be as high as 80% in like meat and bone meal, for instance. So the rumen undegradable fraction is the fraction that goes directly through the rumen and has the opportunity to be absorbed through the small intestine. Our rumen degradable fraction is going to be broken down into ammonia and other nitrogen-based compounds. And when we have a sufficient carbon skeleton, so enough TDN in the system, we couple that TDN with the ammonia, and we make microbial crude protein. Now, when we have excess ammonia, that actually escapes the rumen, goes to the liver, or is deaminated, and turned into nitrogen that is either returned with what we call recycling back into the rumen or through the saliva, or it can be excreted through the urine, or in many instances, when we look at our dairy literature, in the milk. Now, one thing I want to highlight here is so when we couple our rumen undegradable fraction with our microbial crude protein, we end up getting what we refer to as metabolizable protein, or the amount of protein that's available to that animal through the small intestine. So when we think about protein, we're feeding the rumen so that we can feed the cow. other thing I think we need to talk about just briefly here is that a lot of what I'm going to focus on today, we're going to talk about plasma urea nitrogen. And so, you know, that's this excess nitrogen that is in the bloodstream or in the milk after detoxification through the liver. Now, that's just an indicator of protein status to a certain extent, because when we think about how urea nitrogen is developed, it's all somewhat in relation to total digestible nutrients. So if we feed two cows the same amount of protein but differing levels of energy, we get different resulting plasma urea nitrogen concentrations. So if we have a low TDN, we can't utilize all of that nitrogen effectively. We can't turn all that ammonia into microbial protein. So we actually get an increase in plasma urea nitrogen. If we have adequate or excess energy relative to nitrogen or crude protein, then we actually lower that plasma urea nitrogen concentration. So just keep that in mind as we progress through some of these slides here. And so, you know, I think everybody's probably heard of the theory that excess crude protein's a bad thing. And most of it, I want to highlight, most of that data surfaces from the dairy literature. And this is kind of the seminal paper, the seminal data that we tend to go by. And so, Dr. Butler's group up at Cornell has done a host of studies in the 90s and early 2000s looking at the effects of excess protein or the correlation between plasma urea nitrogen and its effects on fertility. And whether you look at plasma urea nitrogen or milk urea nitrogen, basically what they developed or came up with and determined was that cows in excess of 19 nanograms per deciliter for plasma urea nitrogen or milk urea nitrogen had suppressed fertility. Now, what's the reason behind that? Or what is the potential association? What's the driving factor behind that association? Well, I think the big one that we often talk about, it's uterine pH. So a lot of people reference that. So we have a high crude protein content in the diet, perhaps excessive, potentially leads to altered uterine pH. So when we look at this particular slide here, our dotted lines are normal and high crude protein or plasma urea nitrogen concentrations on the same day. And what you'll notice is when we have excess or high plasma urea nitrogen concentrations, we actually suppress uterine pH. So we drop uterine pH. And so the question is, well, if we have too much protein, are we affecting the uterine environment? Is it too hostile for that embryo to survive? I think that's a really interesting concept. You know, I think that's the one that a lot of us tend to grab a hold of. We say it's all about uterine environment. Well, Shelley Rhodes, during some of her PhD work, took this a step further and went beyond uterine environment. This is a somewhat limited data set in terms of animals, but I think it's really interesting because what they did is they had donor cows and recipients that had high plasma urea nitrogen concentrations and low plasma urea nitrogen concentrations. And what they found was when you compare donor females, those with a high plasma urea nitrogen concentration, when they did a reciprocal flush and implanted embryos from those donor cows, those cows with a high plasma urea nitrogen concentration had suppressed fertility, or fewer of their embryos settled in those recipient females. But when you compare those recipient females that were either had a high or low plasma urea nitrogen concentration, there's no difference. And at least this data set would indicate that maybe it's not a uterine environment situation, but perhaps it's an oocyte quality situation, because they're able to show that we can actually see a buildup of ammonia in that follicular fluid, perhaps compromising the oocyte quality. Now, there's also been a lot of data out there that would suggest, when we go back to the uterine pH, you know, there's been a lot of data on the male side that's shown that when we alter uterine pH, it can impair sperm motility. So when we drop uterine pH, we actually demobilize those sperm cells a little bit. So undercapacitation could be an issue with some of these cows if we introduce semen into that environment. It's a little bit hypothetical. I don't know if there's a lot of data to support that, but there is something to be said that it could impair sperm motility as well. But I want to reemphasize, that's all dairy cattle data. And so the question becomes, you know, I think we've been relying on dairy cattle data to tell the story on beef cows. Now, I think we can all agree in this room that metabolically, those are totally different beasts, right? In terms of demands for lactation, energy, protein, the whole nine yards. And so I kind of want to highlight where we're at in terms of the beef industry right now, and at least, particularly here in the Midwest. I understand we got a very diverse crowd from all over the United States, so maybe this isn't representative of everyone, but I think cost of production is always something that we wrestle with here in the Midwest, particularly when we look at what our opportunity costs are. We could be row cropping that ground. You know, our cost of production is highly variable. Both our land prices and our inputs are highly volatile from year to year. And we start talking about these alternative feeding systems. And I don't think co-products here in the Midwest is necessarily an alternative feeding system anymore. It's actually the staple. But, you know, a decade ago, we were still trying to figure out how to feed all these co-products and distillers, grains. It was an alternative system. And when I highlight alternative system, this is kind of what I think about today. And we brought this up a couple of different times. But I think these two pictures just really depict how polarizing our system is, particularly here in the Midwest. You know, we've got individuals that have went to complete confinement 365 days a year. I know a few of them that have been in that situation for 4 years now. We have other people that are extensive grazers. They graze 365 days a year. And what I want you guys to think about or conceptualize is, what do the diets look like for these different environments? Anybody that's heard Rick Rasby talk a lot about their confinement system in Nebraska? Their base ration is basically straw and wet distiller's grains. Here in the Midwest, or a little further east, we may look at it as corn stalks and wet distiller's grains. But it's usually a 60-40 or 40-60 mix one way or the other, depending on their stage of production. So basically, we're meeting their energy demands with a very nutrient-dense diet that often exceeds their crude protein requirements. A lot of times it's 125, 150, maybe 175% of their crude protein requirements per the 2000 NRC. Whereas we look at these cattle in an extensive environment around the time of the breeding season, that pasture is pretty lush, maybe 20% or more crude protein. So regardless of our production system, even though it's very diverse, in many instances around the time of breeding, it's very easy to exceed what is quote-unquote our requirement for crude protein. And so I want to highlight, before I get too much further in, by a show of hands, how many of you guys own this particular book that's up on the screen? Handful of you. So for those of you who don't have this, this is the Nutrient Requirements for Beef Cattle manual that originally came out in 1996. It was updated in 2000. And when we think about all the data I'm going to show you, I'll be the first to admit it's already antiquated because the new NRC came out this summer. And so what is excess protein may be slightly different, and we'll get to that here in a little bit. But, you know, I think excess protein is something that's always been on people's minds, maybe a little bit more on the forefront here in the last decade. For whatever reason, when distillers' grains came about, we got a lot more questions about, can we feed them to cows? Is it a problem beyond protein or beyond sulfur? Is there a problem with protein? And so a lot of my PhD work when I was at Purdue looked at this. Can we basically utilize distiller's grains or this co-product feedstuff as an energy source, as a replacement for corn, meet their energy requirements? What is it due to fertility? Is that excess protein, that 150% of the requirements, is that a problem? And so we had some two-year-old females that were basically getting fed all they could eat on corn stalks and 15 pounds of dried distiller's grains a day. That's what met their energy requirements. We had some really high lactating two-year-olds. What I want to point out here is those females that were on distiller's grains, that 15 pounds of distiller's grains, compared to females that were basically being fed a corn silage and haylage based TMR, those females fed distiller's grains tended to resume cyclicity earlier. And when we look at our plasma urea nitrogen concentrations around the time of breeding, so at AI, drastically different, right? Our distiller's grains cows, 17 nanograms per mil, or I'm sorry, milligrams per deciliter. Not surprising. Now, I'll be the first to admit that's not that 19 that I showed you earlier on the dairy literature, but it's getting really close. What it mean in terms of fertility? And so that particular study is study number one outlined here on this slide, but we also did two subsequent studies that were basically the same idea. We were feeding low-quality forage and distiller's grains to meet energy requirements. And across the board, we saw an increase in pregnancy rates. at the end of the day is about a 28% increase, 14 percentage points. And so the question became, well, was it a protein effect? Was it an energy effect? We think about distiller's grains and how they're formed. We have a lot of unsaturated fatty acids in there. And so there's been a host of data, particularly on the dairy side. Dr. Bilby's standing up back there. Some work that he did during some of his programs at Florida. But we know that if we increase polyunsaturated fatty acids, we know that we can increase follicle size, pregnancy rates. They've been shown to shorten that postpartum anestrus period, improve embryo quality, and then, you know, we've seen a lot of data with feeding distiller's grains out in Nebraska that it, at least a supplementation strategy on heifers improves pregnancy rate. So obviously, you know, all the credit has to be given to the unsaturated fatty acids in the distiller's grains, right? Well, not so fast, because if crude protein's a problem and unsaturated fatty acids are a good thing, wouldn't we just see a wash? Why do we see such an improvement in pregnancy rate? You know, is there a synergistic approach? And so a lot of the work that we've been doing here recently, try and take that in the next step further. If we take the excess energy, the unsaturated fatty acids out of the equation, if we just focus on protein, is excess protein really a good thing on the beef side? And so a lot of the work we've been doing and a lot of the work that Taylor did during her master's program focused on ovarian function. I understand that doesn't directly relate to fertility, but it gives us at least a preliminary indicator of what's going on. So ovarian function, I'm talking about follicle growth, number of antral follicles, which we really don't have a talk focusing on that specifically this week, but I think Dr. Cushman's going to hit on that a little bit tomorrow. And so some of the preliminary data that I put together at Purdue basically looked at feeding cows what they needed for both energy and protein versus cows that were being fed corn gluten meal. So similar corn protein source, but at 150% of their protein requirements. And what we saw was an increase in ovulatory follicle size. And Dr. Perry did a lot of work during his PhD program that would suggest that, within reason, increased ovulatory follicle size increases fertility. Now, we know a lot more now about the driving factors behind estradiol and some other things go along with it, but it's safe to say in most instances, all things considered equal, if those follicles are the same age, a bigger follicle is typically a good thing. In that same study, so again, our ovulatory follicle diameter, about 2.5 millimeters bigger. Estradiol tended to be greater in that particular study when we were feeding 150% of protein requirements. We look at total antral follicles for the duration of that follicular wave. We actually were able to manipulate those cows to have a greater number of antral follicles, which, again, Dr. Cushman's data would suggest is typically a good thing in terms of fertility. Now, the one thing I'll point out here is I'll be the first to show you that at 7 days post-AI, we actually had a tendency for suppressed progesterone concentrations, but based on University of Missouri data, it was still sufficient to support pregnancy at that stage. We haven't been able to extrapolate out further to fertility. So taking that a step further, now we're getting into some of Taylor's data here, but so we wanted to look at this previous study here was looking at basically meeting requirements versus 150%. We tried to put together a little bit of a titration study. We were limited in terms of the number of cows that we had available to us, but we looked at cows that were fed enough gluten meal to meet 125% of the requirements or 150%, and again, we've seen a titration effect. So those cows that were on 150% of protein requirements had improved follicle size and ovulation relative to those that were only at 125% of requirements. Same studies. Corn stalks had libidum with gluten meal supplemented to meet those requirements. Again, within that study of hers, ovulatory follicle diameter was greater in those cows that were fed more protein. And again, average follicle count increased. We don't exactly know the mechanism behind that, but it's interesting nonetheless. Again, similar to the previous study I showed, we saw decreased corpus luteum volume in those females 7 days post-estrus. You know, that there are some potential problems there, so we'll circle back to that. Taking that a step further, the question becomes, is it just the amount of protein or is it source of protein? Because particularly when you look at a lot of the dairy literature, they always focus on degradable intake protein. Rumen degradable protein and the negative effects there, because as I showed you earlier, when we feed a lot of excess rumen degradable protein, that's when we get a lot of that ammonia buildup. But what if we're feeding more rumen undegradable protein. And, you know, Rick talked earlier about rumen undegradable protein. John talked a little bit about supplementation, how it appears to be a good thing. So we looked at a feed source, a soybean meal, which is relatively degradable, versus a less degradable corn gluten meal. Same theory, 150% of their protein requirements, comparing them head-to-head. Proestrus duration was longer in those females that were fed soybean meal. Ovulatory follicle diameter, however, was greater in our RUP supplement, if you will, so our corn gluten meal, so RUP heavy. But what about fertility? And that for most of you in here, that's all that matters. You don't care about all the things that lead up to it in terms of all the ins and outs, but at the end of the day, we want a pregnancy, right? And so taking it a step further, I'm going to start off with what heifer data is available, at least in terms of excess protein. This data here is not cited as frequently as I would expect it to be 100% honest with you. A little bit smaller data set out of Oklahoma State, but these heifers here, I think there's about 40 in each treatment, if I remember correctly, and those heifers were either in a dry lot or grazing wheat pasture leading up to the time of artificial insemination. And as you'll notice, those females on wheat pasture peaked out at about 30 milligrams per deciliter in terms of their plasma urea nitrogen, trailed off a little bit, but still there around that 18 to 20 range that typically we think of being detrimental to pregnancy. When we look at where they ended up in terms of fertility, in fact, those females that were grazing wheat pasture had excess crude protein. Higher proportion of those tended to be cycling at the beginning of the breeding season. But they saw no differences in fertility and pregnancy rate. So suggesting that excess protein maybe not totally beneficial from a fertility perspective, but not detrimental. This data here is hot off the presses out of Dr. Perry's lab. Just want to highlight here that they had 60 heifers in each treatment that were fed either a 10% protein or a 14% crude protein diet. And they looked at a host of things, but in particular, I want to focus on pregnancy rates. That's the bottom line on this first table here, table 3. No difference in pregnancy rates. And when we look at a subset of those females where they actually looked at some oocyte development, oocyte quality factors, no differences there. So again, while excess protein wasn't beneficial, it wasn't detrimental to these developing heifers. But what about on cows? Particularly when we think about these cows that are typically out grazing a 20%+ crude protein feed stuff, this fresh growing grass in the Midwest, what's the problem? Is there a problem? And so working with some data from Mineral Research Center, a lot of blood samples I'd collected myself over the years, as well as some data from Dr. Perry, we analyzed about 1,300 blood samples and for plasma urea nitrogen concentrations. These were the plasma urea nitrogen concentrations of these females at the time of seeder insertion, so the beginning of a synchronization protocol. Caveat here being that all of the females in this particular trial, and even the couple trials I showed you before, had been acclimated to that diet for at least 21 days. I think in the case of the previous study here, I think they were on those diets for at least 60 days prior to the beginning of the breeding season. In this instance here, all these cattle had been acclimated to either pasture or their whatever nutritional program they had been on for at least 21 days. Because there has been some data suggests that cattle can acclimate metabolically to an increased ammonia load over time. And what I want to point out here is basically we just took all the cattle, all the pregnancy rates, and we looked at were they above or below each integer from 10 to 25 milligrams per deciliter for plasma urea nitrogen. The only reason I didn't go above or below that is because we just simply ran out of numbers. But what I want to point out here is for the most part, we saw no differences. The only thing that we tended to see a difference in was actually at 16 milligrams per deciliter. Those females that were increased in terms of their plasma urea nitrogen concentrations actually tended to have a greater pregnancy rate. So cycling back around to the old rule of thumb that we always used to say 19 is the dreaded number, while not statistically significant, we actually saw a numerical improvement within those cattle, so no difference in terms of pregnancy rate relative to that plasma urea nitrogen concentration. Again, we look at over versus under 16 milligrams per deciliter, tended to be an increase in terms of those females that were over 16. And we looked at it over the entire spectrum of these females. What I thought was really interesting And most of you academics in here will tell me that an R value of 0.05 is atrocious. I'm not going to call this a tendency because it's not a very good one because our correlation isn't very good, but that's what you get when you have binary data. Basically, what I want to point out is that over the duration of this data set, it doesn't appear that protein's a problem, at least if those cattle have been acclimated. And so now I say all that, and you know we talk about excess or lack thereof. That was based on the 2000 NRC model. Now we've got the 2016 NRC model. And it's kind of tilting things on its ear a little bit. Because primarily, I talked about earlier in this particular talk, we always focused on protein from a total protein, a crude protein balancing perspective, right? We switched it now. We're now in a metabolizable protein system. So we have to think about more than just how much protein's going in the front end. We also got to take into consideration how much energy is available to make that microbial protein, how much recycling is going to be incorporated based on passage rates, based on feedstuffs. There's some new data out. Well, I wouldn't say it's new data, but there's some new guidelines within this document that suggest that maybe there's some differences in efficiency of digestion of protein relative to what we thought there was with some different feedstuffs. So a whole host of changes. With that, I'd also like to point out, moving forward, what we used to call undegradable intake protein or bypass protein, and what we used to call DIP or degradable intake protein is no longer going to be utilized. So for the most part, we should be utilizing RUP and RDP. So that's just kind of a side note to today. But, you know, at least initially, this document, when we think about, particularly with those cows grazing that very lush forage, passage rate's usually very high. A lot of times our TDN is not great. So what we used to think being a very lush pasture is actually very excessive in protein, the new model would suggest that maybe it's not as excessive in protein as we once thought it was. So again, that whole excess and how much excess is changing. We still are trying to wrap our hands around what the new model means in terms of cow management on the nutrition side of things. But in conclusion, for at least the data I've shown with you guys today, I cannot definitively say that protein does not have a negative effect on reproduction in the beef herd. What I can tell you is, based on the data that's available, if those cattle are adapted to their environment and their metabolism has adapted to the nutrients in which they're going to see at the time of artificial insemination or beginning of the breeding season, it doesn't appear to be a problem. What we don't know is about acute swings in protein. So if we see a drastic increase in protein for a couple days around the time of insemination, is that a problem? I'm not sure. If we think back to how I talked about protein metabolism and TDN playing a very large role, again, I think it gets back to some of what Dr. Perry talked about, where maybe it's more of an issue, particularly even with that dairy data, I think it's more of an imbalance between energy and protein than it is solely protein by itself. And even the dairy literature, you look at it, it's all associative. It's not cause and effect. So just something to think about there. And so talked about this, the new nutrient requirement document may change the way we actually look at excess protein, how much excess protein we're actually feeding. Next steps, I think, obviously, some of that data I showed you earlier on ovarian function only goes so far. We need to get that extrapolated out to what it means in terms of fertility, whether source and amount makes any difference on the beef side like it does on dairy. And then I think coming down the pipeline, the dairy industry has already started to adapt to more of an amino acid balancing system. I think there's some room to look at bypass amino acids, specific amino acids, and how it's going to impact fertility down the road. Are there some supplements that we can develop that are at least cost-friendly on the producer end of things that can improve our protein management, our fertility? With that, I know Rick always puts a plug in for their website. I'd be remiss if I didn't do the same thing with ours. Please check out iowabeefcenter.org. We had almost 1.5 million hits in the last calendar year. We have a Facebook page. And we're Twitter friendly. So with that, I'd be happy to take a question or two if we've got a couple of minutes.